You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the last 4 years, the relationship between the Obama White House and the Roberts Supreme Court has gotten rather tense at times. In his latest book, The Oath, Jeffrey Toobin tells the recent history of the Supreme Court and the tangles it's had with the president. The book is published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased to welcome Jeffrey Toobin back to our show.
Hi, Lenny.
Do you think that Obama and Roberts embody a larger conflict about how to interpret the Constitution? They're both constitutional scholars, aren't they?
I do. And one thing that's so appealing about writing about the two of them is that at once they have a lot in common, but their differences, frankly, are more important. They're both close in age. They're both princes of the meritocracy, both products of Harvard Law School and the Harvard Law Review. But one of them really believes in change. One of them really wants to see the law change in dramatic ways. And it's not Barack Obama. John Roberts is part of a conservative movement that really has a long agenda for the courts, and he's trying to implement it.
Well, Obama was the president of the Harvard Law Review. Roberts wasn't there at the time.
No, they didn't overlap.
But do you think their experiences at the publication helped shape who they turned out to be as leaders?
Well, I think they are similar in that they both know what the heck they're talking about. It's very easy to spout off about constitutional law without knowing much about it, but these are two men who are deeply knowledgeable about the history of the Constitution. Their politics inform their views, and one of the questions I often get is, why can't they just do law, not politics, about the Supreme Court? But it is a deeply political institution, always has been, always will be, and that's reflected in the two men's views of the Constitution.
What about their post-law school experiences? Do you think that has had an impact on how they view the world, or were they already the people we know today when they were at Harvard?
Well, I think they were similar. I think they have not changed dramatically, but they did take dramatically different career paths. John Roberts clerked first here in New York for Henry Friendly, a legendary judge, then William Rehnquist, who was then an associate judge in the associate justice on the Supreme Court. Obama, I think it's his post law school career is most interesting because of what he didn't do. He never clerked. He was offered a clerkship on the D.C. Circuit. He easily could have gotten a Supreme Court clerkship. But the core of Obama's belief about the Constitution is that change comes from politics, not the courts. He is a product of the civil rights movement, as he acknowledges. Thurgood Marshall is someone, obviously, he respects a great deal. But he thinks that liberals have placed too much faith in the courts, and you could argue that he's placed too little.
Well, we have Board of Education, a major moment in the civil rights, the history of civil rights. But Obama believes that Lyndon Johnson's civil rights laws were more important.
I don't know about more important, but he certainly thinks the way he wanted to make progressive change as an individual, what he wanted to devote his life to, was running for office, not being a judge. I mean, given his background, he could easily have gone the judge track. And he kept a foot in that world. He taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago for a long time, for a decade. But he never fully committed to it. He never was tenure track, and he really has devoted his life to politics.
And as a senator, he voted against Roberts' elevation to the court. Was that on political or ideological grounds?
Well, what's so interesting about Obama's struggle with his vote on the Roberts confirmation was that it was such a struggle. A lot of Democrats, like, for example, his rival at the time, Hillary Clinton, they knew that, look, George W. Bush's nomination to the Supreme Court, you just vote against. I mean, that is what it means.
Especially since both of them had aspirations to become president and they'd have to deal with him.
Well, and they were running in Democratic primaries where the primary voters care a lot about these issues. But Obama was very torn on the subject. And the day after he voted against John Roberts, he did something very unusual in his career. He wrote a commentary for Daily Kos, which is the liberal blog, and he said, look, some of my Democratic colleagues like Pat Leahy and Russ Feingold, they voted to confirm Roberts. don't be mad at them. I can understand why they did what they did. So it's very characteristic of Obama to sort of try to keep both sides happy.
Do you think Roberts is aware of that, or is he irked that that Obama voted against him?
You know, I think there's a difference between John Roberts and Samuel Alito there. John Roberts is, I think, a little more worldly about politics than Samuel Alito. Both Obama and Biden voted against both of them. But Alito has been much more of a grudge holder on the subject. Roberts, I think, is a more worldly figure, understands politics a little better, and did not hold it against Obama that he voted against him.
You begin the book with the flubbed oath. Was that just a thoughtless mistake on Roberts' part?
Well, no. You know, it's a great story. I actually, you know, one of the great things about being a journalist is that, you know, you get to cover stories as they're happening. But one of the problems with being a journalist is the circus moves along very quickly and people forget about stuff that seemed very important at the time. And the flubbed oath was I thought, a classic story. What the heck happened?
But so much was made of it at the time.
Right. Well, and for the first time in American history, the oath was redone the next day. You know, a lot of people criticized Roberts and they said, oh, well, he – you know, he didn't practice. He sort of blew it off. Quite the opposite is true. He practiced so much that his wife said to him at one point, you know, at this point, the dog thinks it's the president. So, you know, it was hardly an absence of practice. The real story is the story of a mislaid email. Roberts and his top aide, Jeffrey Muneer, very meticulously printed out on a card how they were going to divide up the words in the oath. And Muneer's secretary forwarded it to his secretary on the committee of the Congress that was supervising in the inauguration. That secretary didn't read it, didn't open it, deleted it, just never forwarded it on to Obama's office. So Obama didn't know how Roberts was going to divide up the words, and he sort of jumped the gun, Obama did, on the occasion of the inauguration, on that flustered Roberts, most uncharacteristically, and that led to the problems in the oath.
Okay, so Roberts is the Chief Justice. Some Chief Justices have their names attached to the courts that they ran. Others have become rather anonymous. What are Roberts' ambitions?
Oh, I think they are very large and important. I mean, John Roberts is a product of the Reagan administration when Edwin Meese was remaking American courts with a broad-ranging agenda: expand executive power, increase the use of the death penalty, lower the barriers between church and state, eliminate racial preferences intended to assist African Americans, and above all, reverse Roe versus Wade and allow states once again to ban abortion. I think that was the Reagan agenda. It has become more the core of the Republican agenda over the past 30 years, and it's what John Roberts believes in.
And he believes that the courts can make major changes, as you said. He has the opportunity to have a much larger impact than any president, because a president, even if reelected, is there for 8 years. Roberts is a young man. Who knows how many years he's going to be Chief Justice?
He was appointed not long after his 50th birthday. He was 53 at the time of 2009, the inauguration. I think he'll be there a long time. But you know, his success as Chief Justice is dependent on Republicans winning presidential elections, because justices are only influential if they can get to five votes. And the president who appoints justices will control the outcome of the court.
But the Republican justices, and we can say that in the past, it was always a little more complicated when we look at some of the justices of the past. But they're all fairly young. In fact, the oldest ones on the court are the liberals.
No, it's split, actually. The oldest justice is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's 79. The next two oldest are both Republicans. Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy are both 76. And then Stephen Breyer is 74. So there does appear to be generational change in the offing at the court. But you never know exactly how long a justice is going to serve.
Haven't many Supreme Court judges drifted ideological over the course of their tenures? Chief Justice Earl Warren was appointed by a Republican So were David Souter and John Paul Stevens. On the other hand, we've had people like William Rehnquist, who Roberts, you say, clerked for, who remained fairly consistent throughout his time on the Supreme Court.
You know, I think the idea that justices change, that presidents are surprised, is largely a myth about the Supreme Court. Overwhelmingly, what you see is what you get with Supreme Court nominees. Yes, it is true that Eisenhower made two appointments that were surprises to him, Earl Warren and William Brennan. But if you look at the current court, there are no surprises on that court. And David Souter was never going to be a particularly conservative justice. So I think the number of surprises is few and declining.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. His latest book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. I'd like to play a clip from Roberts' confirmation hearings. Senator Herb Kohl asked what role he thinks the court should play in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and cases that might arise from it.
Well, the courts are, of course, passive institutions. We hear cases that are brought before us. We don't go out and bring cases. We don't have the constitutional authority to execute the law. We don't have the constitutional authority to make the law.
Do you think that Roberts has lived up to that?
Well, and you know, there's another famous passage in his congressional testimony when he was up for his hearings, where he described himself as an umpire. Mm-hmm. He was not. He was just going to sort of call balls and strikes. I think he has been much more the commissioner of baseball during his tenure. And you need only look at the signature decision of the Roberts Court, Citizens United, which has remade American campaign finance law, overturned several precedents, overturned the McCain-Feingold campaign law, which was still not that old. I think he has been more aggressive than he suggested he would be.
And you're suggesting that they actually made law with that. Didn't the court have an opportunity to make a rather narrow ruling in that case and rather than just throw out the entire McCain-Feingold bill?
Well, you know, the Citizens United is really the core of my book, The Oath. It is such a wonderful story in so many respects because it has so many aspects to it. It was the first case Elena Kagan ever argued. It was Sonia Sotomayor's first case as a justice on the Supreme Court. It was John Paul Stevens' farewell to the court. But why Citizens United is so important is that it was a very narrow case about a very obscure movie made about Hillary Clinton, and the court could have disposed of it in a very uncontroversial way. But instead, Justice Kennedy's opinion became a vehicle to remake decades of constitutional law, and we're seeing the aftermath in this campaign.
So why do you think Justice Kennedy, who often is thought of as the swing vote, made such a broad ruling in Citizens United?
Well, this goes to the question of motive, which is always the hardest question to answer.
He wrote his decision,
Justice Kennedy, I think, has rather romantic ideas about the First Amendment, and the core idea about in Citizens United are two ideas: that corporations are people, and that money is speech. And I think Justice Kennedy became so enamored with these abstractions that he really he didn't see the practical significance, or if he did, it didn't bother him because this is a decision that helps Republicans a lot.
Roberts assigned the ruling to Kennedy. He must have known where he was going to go,
and he joined the opinion. Chief Justice Roberts is as responsible for the opinion as the author.
So you don't think we should be surprised? The reason I mention that is, as I said, Kennedy is often thought of as a swing vote. Many liberals sometimes pin their hopes for a victory in certain cases on Kennedy coming over to their side, as he has done in a number of gay rights cases.
Right. I mean, Kennedy, I think it's a mistake, because he's in the middle of the court, to describe him as a moderate. He's really not a moderate. He actually has very strong views. It's just that he's unpredictable in which views they go. On the First Amendment, he has these very absolutist views, which sometimes are good when the press has a case. He is fairly sympathetic to death penalty defendants. As you point out, he's been the court's strongest voice on gay rights. But on most issues, He is quite conservative, as we saw in the healthcare case, for example.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer at The New Yorker, senior legal analyst at CNN, best-selling author of The Nine, Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life. And now he has another bestseller with The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, is published by Doubleday. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Jeffrey Toobin, whose latest book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, published by Doubleday. Back to Citizens United. It has its origins in an obscure case involving railroads in the 1880s. How did it come to be applied here?
Well, the question of whether corporations have the same rights as people is an issue that the court has struggled with for a long time. And, you know, a lot of my liberal friends are always outraged by that notion. But it is actually not a crazy or even all that controversial notion. For example, when you talk about the First Amendment, the New York Times, CNN, WNYC, they all rely on the First Amendment for news gathering, and they are all corporations. WNYC is nonprofit, CNN is for profit, but still they have First Amendment rights. That case from the 19th century involved the court starting to sort out that issue, and what made it so odd in Citizens United is that the court had historically said, yes, corporations have some First Amendment rights, but they can be regulated differently than an individual's First Amendment rights. And Justice Kennedy's opinion basically said corporations and people have virtually identical rights, and that had large implications for the idea of campaign finance.
In a recent speech, former Justice Stevens speculated about whether we'll soon have to confront the question of whether Citizens United applies to the ability of foreign corporations, and predicted that creating an exception for foreign corporations will create a crack in the foundation of the Citizens United majority.
Maybe. I mean, I think, you know, that issue of whether Citizens United applies to foreign corporations, that was the subject that was the bone of contention between President Obama and Justice Alito at the State of the Union address. Alito said not true when Obama said, you know, this will be extended to foreign corporations. You know, my sense is I don't think this court is getting ready to cut back on Citizens United at all. I think they're happy with the decision, and they have been expanding it, not cutting it back.
Well, they found this precedent from the 1880s. Often that's what happens. You find a case that had nothing to do on the most obvious level with what's going on now, and you apply the precedent. But there were quite a few recent precedents about campaign spending that they did overturn. So do you pick and choose your precedents?
Well, that's why being a Supreme Court justice is such a political job, is that it is not merely robotically applying the precedents of the court. They sometimes overturn them. Liberals are often happy when precedents are overturned. Liberals were very happy when Bowers v. Hardwick, the gay rights case, was overturned in 2003 by Lawrence v. Texas. But conservatives were happy when Citizens United overturned several campaign finance precedents.
And then we talked earlier about the political versus the judicial, you know, the executive branch or the legislative branch versus the judicial. That's what happened in the case of Lilly Ledbetter. The court found against her, and Justice Ginsburg wrote this stirring dissent that led Congress to come up with a law.
I mean, you know, Justice Ginsburg is such a remarkable figure, and the story of her involvement in the Lilly Ledbetter case had never really been fully told before. And basically, she used her dissenting opinion to say, hey, Congress, wake up. You can fix this. And it was just at the time that Congress had that the Democrats had retaken the House and Senate, and Nancy Pelosi and embraced the subject. And it really is a stirring moment when the first law that Barack Obama signed as president was the Lilly Ledbetter Act. And there's a photograph in my book of Lilly Ledbetter herself, this woman who worked at the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Plant in Gaston, Alabama, coming down in the East Room and with the President of the United States, and Joe Biden is bawling like a baby. He's so moved by that. And it really is an example of how the system can work, and some obscure person can have an enormous impact.
She was a guest on our show. I think that she pointed out that she had voted Republican for most of her life and then was stunned when so many people in the party that she had supported were against her.
Well, and one of the real signatures of the Roberts Court has been in cases involving individuals against corporations, as the Lilly Ledbetter case was, Ledbetter versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber, it has sided with corporations so many times that the idea of individuals seeking redress for discrimination has gotten considerably harder. Lilly Ledbetter is only the most celebrated example of a big, important trend in the Roberts Court.
You've given one of your chapters the title, The Thomas Court. You believe that even though he doesn't talk, he is perhaps the most influential of all the justices on the right?
Well, there's certainly he's certainly much more influential than people think he is. I mean, he's got this bizarre—
Everybody thought it was Antonin Scalia.
Well, no, Justice Scalia has been very influential. But, you know, when you look back at some of the most celebrated or notorious, depending on your point of view, cases— it has been Justice Thomas who brought those ideas to the Supreme Court. For example, gun control, the idea that individuals have a right to possess a weapon under the Second Amendment. It was Thomas who brought that ideas to the court. Several of the ideas underlying Citizens United, Thomas brought to the court. The view of the Commerce Clause that almost prevailed and overturned Obamacare, that had been pioneered by Justice Thomas in a decision from 1995. You know, he is the most vivid demonstration of how far to the court has moved to the right, because ideas that seemed very much out there when he introduced them have on several occasions become majority opinions.
Now, you had to hold up completing this book until the so-called Obamacare decision.
I sure did.
And you were predicting that it was going to go the other way.
Well, you know, one of the problems with working at CNN is they keep the tapes of what you say. And so I cannot say that I predicted all along that the case would turn out the way it did. No, I was completely shocked, particularly after the oral argument where Donald Verrilli, the Solicitor General, received such a hard time from the conservative justices. But fortunately, when I was writing the oath, I had time to go back, do more reporting, and try to figure out what the heck happened.
Well, Verrilli was chastised for presenting a rather weak case. Do you think he did?
I criticized him, but I am now in a full eating crow mode, eating humble pie. Don Verrilli won the case, and I think that's the most important thing to say about his performance.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. His latest book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But you don't have to apologize totally. For a long time, Roberts seems to have decided to vote with the conservative group. You know, it was only at the end that he changed his mind.
It was an extraordinary behind-the-scenes drama at the Supreme Court involving the Obamacare case. And, you know, I think it was an example of John Roberts seeing himself as the institutional custodian of the court's reputation. He knew that in the public mind, the Obamacare case was a trilogy with Bush v. Gore in 2000, Citizens United in 2010. Both cases were five Republican justices issued harshly partisan rulings. He didn't want the court to be seen as just another place where Democrats and Republicans fight. So he found this novel argument that had not been emphasized by the parties about the taxing power. He upheld most of the law, and I think he made himself bulletproof for accusations of partisanship for the rest of his tenure, which will be a long time.
And some people said to assure that he will have a place in history.
You know, I think that is not exactly how his thought process worked, although I don't want to overstate how much I know about his thought process. I think mostly he cared about the result, and he cared about the court not being seen as a bunch of partisan hacks.
Wasn't the individual mandate largely uncontroversial legally?
Well, I mean, that again is why this case is such a bizarre and fascinating tale, because, you know, the individual mandate was an idea pioneered by the Heritage Foundation in the late 80s, a very conservative think tank. It had been embraced mostly by Republicans like Newt Gingrich as an alternative to Bill Clinton's health care plan.
And it's the reason that that Mitt Romney brought it to Massachusetts.
Exactly. It is, in all functional aspects, the Massachusetts plan is virtually identical to the Obamacare plan. But what happened was, once Obama embraced it, there is this tremendous conservative intellectual judicial machinery that started cranking up against it and invented the argument that it was unconstitutional. And I think one reason Roberts rejected that argument ultimately is that it was so transparently political rather than having a history in the conservative movement.
What about all the ridicule that Justice Scalia got when he said that this might mean that the government will force you to eat broccoli? Well, which, by the way, he didn't – I gather he got from somebody else.
Right. I mean, you know, one of the I mean, Justice Scalia is a remarkable figure. He has brought ideas to the court that have turned out to be very important. But to be honest, he's getting kind of old and cranky. And he has really developed a lot of his references now from Fox News. He was talking about things like the Cornhusker kickback that weren't even part of the law, the broccoli issue. You know, could the government force you to buy eat broccoli?
Which didn't he also complain that he was going to have to read all 2,500 pages of the law?
Right. I mean, he
isn't that what judges are supposed to do, or at least their clerks?
Well, he was so outspoken and really disrespectful during the oral argument of the Obamacare case that Chief Justice Roberts sort of shut him down at one point and said, you know, that's enough for frivolity for now. I think you know, his embrace of Republican talking points in the Obamacare case, in the Arizona immigration case, has diminished his reputation on the court. And it just shows that lifetime tenure is not always the best thing for people once they get into their upper 70s.
Now, you mentioned you thought Citizens United is going to be defended by the court in the future, but the court will be ruling in this term about whether American courts can be used by foreign victims to sue over human rights violations abroad. And the Obama Justice Department has reversed its position on this case. This is about Shell Oil and its involvement in Nigeria.
You know, if there was a single case that John Roberts and Samuel Alito were put on this earth to throw out, I think it's this case. I mean, this is a use of an obscure American statute to sue a foreign an American company overseas in a case that has nothing directly to do with the United States. When you look at the pro-corporate orientation of this court, they sure seem destined to toss it out.
But corporations are people.
Well, they're people when it's convenient for them to be people, and they're people, and they're not so people when it's not.
Oh, so we pick and choose the people we hang out with.
People always pick and
choose. Now, a lot of people will thought perhaps that this meant that Justice Roberts was going to change to some degree. Is this an anomaly?
I think Chief Justice Roberts has not discovered his inner moderate. He remains the conservative he's always been. I think the Obamacare case was unique in its political and legal context. But when you look at the case like the one you talked about out of Nigeria, when you look at the future of affirmative action, another issue before the court, the future of the Voting Rights Act, same-sex marriage, we are not going to see a moderate Chief Justice Roberts. We're going to see the conservative he's always been.
Even though Ted Olson, who is a rather conservative lawyer, legal figure. He is a major lawyer in the case for same-sex marriage.
And you need only ask his conservative colleagues about that, and you get lots of eye rolls about Ted Olson. He is very much an anomaly in the conservative legal movement embracing same-sex marriage.
When he was here, he said he thought he could convince Kennedy and maybe one or two of the others.
I admire his optimism.
What do the three retired justices, Sandra Day O'Connor, John Paul Stevens, and David Souter, make of the current court? Are they outspoken about it?
Well,
and where it's headed?
Well, and I think they are very revealing figures because they're very different from each other. Justice O'Connor, this tall, charismatic former politician from Arizona, David Souter, reclusive bachelor from New Hampshire, John Paul Stevens, a wily antitrust lawyer from Chicago. but they have one important thing in common. They are all moderate Republicans who have become completely alienated from the modern Republican Party. And a big theme in the oath is how moderate Republicans have disappeared from the Supreme Court, just like they've disappeared from the House of Representatives in the Senate. It's the biggest trend in American politics, and it's precisely reflected at the Supreme Court.
You note that since 2000, members of the court had an informal agreement not to discuss Bush versus Gore.
It is really kind of remarkable that, you know, that decision 12 years later has never been cited by one justice on even one occasion. And I think that's revealing of what a painful sore that case has been. You know, now four of the justices who were participated in it are gone. I anticipate someone will cite it someday, but I think it is really interesting and revealing that no one has yet put it back in the United States reports.
Well, they won't be able to ignore the Obamacare decision.
Well, I don't think they will.
But we've heard that some conservative justices were so upset by Roberts' decision to uphold the law that they took to leaking to the press.
That is an extraordinary story. The court is usually a hermetically sealed institution for pending cases. Fortunately for my efforts as a journalist, it tends to loosen up after the decisions come down. But during the Obamacare case, there really was an organized effort to try to push Chief Justice Roberts against the law. And there were these leaks from the court that he was getting wobbly in the case. But he stayed wobbly and, as we all know, upheld the law.
You write that justices often remark that outsiders ought to pay more attention to the time of the year that any given opinion has been handed down. Why is that?
Well, because the Supreme Court year, as most people know, goes from the first Monday in October. That's when they start hearing cases. And the last decision usually comes at the end of June. June 28th was the Obamacare decision. Early in the tenure, early in the year, towards November, December, January, they do the uncontroversial cases. They do the cases where they don't disagree with each other that much. They have more time and they're in better spirits. When you start getting into May and June, there's a lot of crankiness on that court, and the dissents get meaner, the opinions get sharper, and that's when it's often interesting to look at the month the decision came down because the tone is often reflected.
Are there any cases coming before the court this term that you're particularly interested in?
There are two. The first is the future of affirmative action and admissions at the University of Texas. But the real question to me is what are they going to do about same-sex marriage? Because there are two cases. There's the Defense of Marriage Act case, and there's the Proposition 8 case out of California. I think they very well may strike down the Defense of Marriage Act because it only applies in states that already have same-sex marriage. I don't think they want to touch the issue of Proposition 8 because that suggests they might impose same-sex marriage in the 44 states that don't have it, and I'm not sure they're ready to take the political heat for doing that.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer at The New Yorker, senior legal analyst at CNN, best-selling author of the latest, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us.
Lenny, great to be with you as always.